Welcome to the Polite Politics Podcast.
Political issues are too important to be decided by grown adults behaving like five-year-olds on a playground.
Your once-a-week guide to the real issues facing America. We'll forget the bias and the yelling.
There are good, honest, intelligent people on both sides of most political issues.
And just tell you what's really happening in America.
Welcome into the Polite Politics Podcast. I'm your host, Tyler Page. Got a great show on deck for you. Going to take a look at Republican economics versus Democrat economics, and my guest is the Speaker of the House of the great state of Utah, Greg Hughes. He's going to talk about that anti-discrimination bill and religious freedom bill that passed, and how Utah's really becoming a leader on the national stage in what it's doing. But first, the big story this week was the clash between President Obama and Senate Democrats. Shoot. Dang it. Okay, let me try this again. Slip every time. 3, 2, 1. Big story, a fight between President Obama and Senate Democrats. Shoot! Duh, it's Republicans. Why? I'm joking. Obviously, President Obama actually had a fight with Senate Democrats this week over a trade bill. And we'll get into economics later, but I want to talk a little bit about this fight because, first off, each week I try to cover the biggest story that happens in Congress, and this was it. So here's the deal. The president wants to negotiate a deal with a bunch of Asian nations that represent a huge percentage of the production in the world. In order to do this, he is asking for what has been given on most trade deals in history, which is called fast-track authority. The problem is in the United States system, we have a division of powers, which has a lot of good, but it also makes it hard for a president to go out and negotiate a deal because then Congress, through its amendment process and other things, may try to water it down or change it. And so other nations aren't willing to deal with the United States or aren't willing to give their best offer because they know Congress will change things. So we call it Trade Promotion Authority. Shorthand is Fast Track. Essentially says the president will sign this agreement and then it has to go to Congress just for an up or down vote. Yes or no, Congress can't amend it, but Congress has to pass a bill to allow this to happen. So President Obama has pushed Fast Track for a 6-year period. He would like to negotiate a bunch of deals with these Asian nations in this Trans-Pacific Partnership. Republicans are on board because they believe if they get a president in place, they would like that ability for that president as well if they can get a Republican elected after President Obama leaves office. The problem is that Democrats have always had a problem with free trade. They're not crazy about it. And that goes into the blue model, which we'll discuss in our next segment. But what you need to understand on free trade is that economists agree almost universally that it's a good thing in the aggregate. Greg Mankiw, former advisor to President Bush, who's a Harvard economist, wrote in his textbooks that free trade should be promoted is nearly an above 90% consensus among economists that it should be promoted. Democrats have said that it hurts little workers, and while free trade is good in the aggregate, it does hurt some groups on the micro level. So if a factory outside the United States can produce something cheaper, that actually produces a lot of growth for the United States. It makes things cheaper for our consumers, makes life better. But for the handful of workers in the American factory who lose their jobs, it's a tough thing. And so Democrats, in championing the little guy, like to stand up for that. What they don't point out and what Republicans say back is, well, those people could use the economic growth to go get better jobs. They just have to get trained. That's where the debate goes back and forth. The Washington Post editorial board called the Democrats' position fighting against the president spurious and the position unjustifiable. For context, the Washington Post editorial board, which endorses candidates and positions and gives the official position of the paper, has never endorsed a Republican for president since it started regularly endorsing presidential candidates in 1976. In 1988, it declined to endorse Michael Dukakis or George H.W. Bush. It is a pro-Democrat board, and it's criticizing the Democrats here. The USA Today editorial board went even further and explained how Democrats were trying to do it with what's called poison pill amendments. Essentially, they try to get amendments in the bill that will kill it, that will force others who support it to withdraw their support. And the USA Today editorial board detailed how that works. The links will be provided on UtahPoliticoHub.com. Now, both parties have anti-intellectual wings of their party. They have wings that fight for things that are just irrational. And for the Democrats, one of those issues is trade. It is better for the country as a whole to promote these free trade agreements, and yet Democrats have been fighting against it. Now, this fight has gotten really ugly, with the key contenders being President Obama and Senator Elizabeth Warren. President Obama said this. This set off an ugly food fight. Senator Sherrod Brown called President Obama sexist. The National Organization for Women, which is an arm of the Democratic Party for all intents and purposes, also called the president sexist. And Republicans have responded just by laughing and saying, this is how President Obama talks about everyone he disagrees with. But Democrats have really reacted negatively to it. Senator Chris Murphy actually agreed with Republicans here, saying, quote, he's not using any different rhetoric here than he has on other issues. It just happens that he's speaking to Democrats. Then he added, Democrats shouldn't take it personally, just like Republicans shouldn't take it personally. Now look, Republicans have taken it personally. I think there's a pretty compelling argument that President Obama was actually pretty soft on Senator Warren here compared to how he treats Republicans. But this dust-up lasted 24 hours. Then the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell agreed to allow, Democrats had wanted some votes on these poison pill amendments that would have killed the bill. And Republicans said, no, those are separate issues and they'll be incorporated separately. Democrats disagreed. Well, now Democrats agreed to allow those votes to happen on separate issues. And so those votes won't kill the bill, but it gives them some symbolic cover when they go back to unions who really have always hated free trade. So it's advanced out of the Senate and it'll be in the House. We'll probably have to talk about it next week or in the weeks after if there is an issue in the House with it passing. So what's the big thing you learn from this? I think President Obama had a fight with the left. I think free trade, this trade promotion authority bill, is critically important. President Obama has called it a centerpiece of his second term. And the ability to sign and pass free trade agreements will improve the lives of all Americans. However, labor unions don't like it, and because labor unions heavily fund Democrats, Democrats have to stand up and try to fight it. And you saw President Obama's tactics that he usually uses by disparaging anyone who disagrees with him just as a politician. They're self-interested, used against Democrats, and you saw how Democrats reacted. Interesting story, interesting, worth the read. If you're interested in it, there'll be links provided. Next, I want to, on a little more lighthearted note, I want to call out some activists in the latest installment of Activists Exposed.
Activists Exposed.
You can't always get what you want. You can't.
Get out of here, you low-life scum.
Next up, you may have noticed that college students across the country have gotten way too much power and have started trying to wield that power in ridiculous ways. As our country and social media have advanced, it's empowered a lot of people, but I think a lot of people are still trying to figure out where the limits of that power should be used. This story just cracks me up, or it would crack me up if it wasn't so plausible. Some students at Western Washington University are seeking to revoke the degree of a politician they disagree with. Seriously. Their position is that Senator Doug Erickson, who represents Ferndale in Washington, and who is not in favor of their carbon tax agenda, but he has been the target of protests, and students are now petitioning the administration to revoke his diploma because they disagree with him politically. This is ridiculous. And this is kind of what our country's coming to. We have a lot of people who have become newly empowered by social media, and that's a good thing. It's a democratizing force. But that force, frankly, has empowered a lot of people who have really crazy ideas. And those people need to start realizing that their ridiculous ideas, when they come out with them, it makes them look bad. And I think society over time will realize that. But what's happened is people have figured out that they're powerful, and they haven't yet gained the discipline that comes traditionally with power. And so they do stupid things like this. And it deserves disrespect and disgrace, and it should be treated that way. And that's why it's my latest installment of Activists Exposed. When we come back, a look at Republican economics and Democrat economics, and then Republican House Speaker Greg Hughes on the pro-religious freedom bill that passed in the state of Utah and gained widespread acclaim nationwide. Thanks for downloading the podcast. Be sure to like the Polite Politics community fan page on Facebook and be sure to tell your friends. Welcome back. You know, all of this discussion of trade suggests that it's time for me to do the in-depth segment I've wanted to do for a long time. I call it Republican economics versus Democrat economics. What I'm going to do here, rather than dive into an individual policy, is explain how Republicans view the economy and how they think it should be improved, and how Democrats view the economy and how they think it should be improved. Hopefully this will give you a context as you seek to understand exactly why we have sharp political disputes today about economic matters. My hope especially is that everyone listening to this can gain a better appreciation for those they disagree with and understand that both sides have intelligent, honest, good-natured intentions about how to make the world a better place. I start with the problem. The problem is simply this. Capitalism requires that there will be winners and losers. In a capitalistic society, some people will make more money than other people. Now, with that said, some say, well, we don't need capitalism. Yes, we do. First, it best protects individual rights. The Cold War is proof of this. Capitalistic societies continue to protect individual rights better than any others, by far. Second, it produces the best society-wide outcomes. The Cold War proved this as well. The standard of living in the United States and in the free world was substantially higher than the standard of living in the communist world over a 70-year period, growing over time, and there was simply no comparison. Capitalism is also inevitable. It is, it exists, and there really is no way to do away with the notion of markets. It's more a question of how we dress them and how we use them. So, how do we create a society where everyone can thrive while harnessing the power of free markets? That's really the tough question, and it's a tough question we've been facing since the 1930s. In the 1930s, FDR, President Roosevelt, pushed through the New Deal. A lot of it was ruled unconstitutional by the courts, but it pushed us very far toward what you would consider a European-style socialism, to the point that some on the right call him a communist. But some of it's kept, some of it's not. And post-World War II, what the eminent scholar Walter Russell Mead calls the blue model emerges. Now, I'm going to link Dr. Mead's article explaining the blue model in depth as part of this segment. But I do want to give just a brief understanding of what the blue model is. I will tell you that in all my years of studying politics and following it, this model helps to understand how both parties think about economics better than just about anything else. So what is the blue model? The blue model was an emerging consensus post-World War II. People went to work for the same firm their entire lives. You went to work for IBM, you were at IBM your whole career. You went to work for General Motors, you were at General Motors for your entire career. As part of this, unions were established that were able to continually negotiate on behalf of workers and increase their standard of living. Each generation made more than the one previous. Government instituted really high taxes and a lot of regulation. What these did was these increased the quality of life for those who lived that set standard way of life. This created pensions that created an ever earlier retirement for those who took them. It also created stability. People weren't out of work because you were always at the same company your entire life. The first third of the article that I'm going to link and will be provided on UtahPoliticalHub.com explains this. However, the blue social model began to break down in the 1970s. This was largely a result of globalization and war-torn nations. Remember, after World War II, the United States, with the exception of Pearl Harbor, we never took an attack on our homeland. And so our infrastructure was still fine. But frankly, most of the rest of the industrialized world had blown itself up. Europe was in shambles. Asia was in shambles. And so the United States had really a huge advantage at the end of World War II. Now, to the United States' credit, and something that I think people point out makes the United States a quote-unquote exceptional nation, is that we gave a lot of that back. We used the Marshall Plan to help build up nations. We rebuilt Germany and Japan. We became the largest charitable entity in the history of the world. We did all of these things. However, by the 1970s, the world's gotten back on its feet. Technology has improved and made the world smaller and smaller, made it easier and easier to trade and ship. And all of a sudden, the government establishing AT&T as the only telephone company monopoly doesn't work anymore. The government had established a few oligopolies, a handful of companies that were theoretically competing, and had given them a lot of protections, and that's what that high regulation environment did. But as that went away, as companies from outside the country start to come in, that's going to disrupt this model. And deregulation encourages this, because in that environment, if you didn't like AT&T, your choice was just not to have a telephone. There wasn't another provider. And so consumer rights advocates and others push, and we end up actually seeing deregulation to help provide a better experience for consumers. More options give consumers power. Now, as this happened, what we have seen is that people don't stay at the same business their whole life. And so a pension doesn't work anymore. Moreover, pensions become way too expensive because those businesses are now facing competition, which require them to be a little more scrupulous about their costs. As a result, the Bloom social model has been breaking down since the 1970s. Democrats want to throw more money and power at the Bloom model. They want higher regulation, higher taxes, and more powerful unions. They see this as the way to make sure that everybody can get ahead and get a chance. Republicans want to tear down this blue social model. Democrats will often characterize this as a return to the 1890 to 1920s robber baron type eras, where people weren't as, where, you know, the poorest among us didn't do too well. Now, here's the question, and it's the question that Democrats pose to Republicans, and so I'm going to answer mostly for the Republicans. I'll give the Democrat response, but candidly, it's the question in all of this. If you tear down the blue social model, if you tear down this blue model and prevent people from having those unions that guarantee those high wages and the high tax rates and all that, what about the little guy who wasn't born in an aristocracy? What about, you know, we all know that no matter how we design our economy, Mitt Romney's going to be fine, right? But what about the guy who didn't get that? What about the guy who didn't go to Harvard? What about the guy who didn't wasn't born to a multimillionaire. How does that person get ahead? And I think both parties talk about this a lot. Democrats, it's unions and it's higher regulation that guarantee they'll be protected in the workplace. And there's a reasonable argument for that. Democrats believe that. Republicans will argue that anyone can get ahead if they're willing to do the work. And doing the work is, one, developing a marketable skill. This usually involves getting a college degree, but not always. Second, working hard. And finally, potentially starting a business. And so to a Republican, anytime you make it harder to run a business, you're hurting the little guy. You're hurting the person who can't get ahead. The reality is that regulation inevitably helps big businesses at the expense of small ones. For example, the Dodd-Frank regulation was the big financial overhaul that came in the light of this latest economic downturn. We're a few years into that. What's happened? The bigger banks are more powerful than they've ever been, and the smaller banks have been driven out of business. Obamacare has done and is continuing to do the same thing to small community hospitals. Small hospitals are getting driven out of business while bigger hospitals are getting more power. The reason for this is simple. People often like to point out that Walmart can afford to pay its employees more. If you raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, Walmart would still be profitable even if it continued its operations exactly as it does. That's true. But guess what? You know who wouldn't still be profitable? The mom and pop shops who are trying to compete with Walmart. The specialty stores that are trying to compete with Walmart. It's those stores that would be driven out of business. And so increased regulation actually makes Walmart more powerful. Now, Democrats disagree with this, and they tend to focus less on circumstances within an individual's control and more on circumstances outside their control to a degree that influence why people can't succeed. Racism and sexism being the most prominent among them, although fortunately those are going down. Disabilities, fortunately our healthcare is getting better. I have a good friend who is a quadriplegic. He literally is paralyzed from the neck down. He has a law degree from Duke University, and he works for the SEC doing very complex stuff. So it is getting more possible for individuals with severe disabilities to get employment, but the truth is not everybody will have that. And so as you look at these two options, as more unions as a solution or more free markets as a solution, like I said, my goal here was not to persuade you to one attitude or another, because you probably have your views on these subjects, and that's fine. But I hope that when you think about them, you'll realize that both sides have honest, good intentions about making the world a better place. When we come back, Speaker of the Utah House, Greg Hughes, on the Utah Anti-Gay Discrimination Bill. Hey, everyone. Thanks for downloading the podcast. Do you disagree with something I said? You're probably not alone. Shoot me an email at tpage@politepolitics.com, and if you make a good point, I'll read it on the air.
My guest today is the Speaker of the Utah House of Representatives, Speaker Greg Hughes. Speaker Hughes, how are you?
Good, Tyler. Thanks for having me on your program.
Well, I'm glad to have you. As we've mentioned, this is very much a national focus, but the state of Utah has changed a lot in the last few years, and they have kind of a unique model of legislation. I wonder if you could talk about the part-time role of legislators and what that's like.
It's a great wrinkle in state government or just elective government in general. Tyler, my day job is I'm a businessman. I've got a small business. I run it. I have to take time away from my day job for 45 calendar days a year to participate in our state's general session. 45 calendar days is roughly about 7 weeks of work, and that is probably one of the shortest general sessions in the country. And where some states, their general session may end and they may prolong it and call themselves back into session and maybe eke towards the fiscal year before they agree on a budget. Our state's practice precedent is to finish up that work on the 45th day at midnight, and that's what we do. So you have a group of people, and you have probably a wide swath of legislators who are truly, they are doctors or lawyers or police officers or school bus drivers or public school teachers. It's a wide array, but short enough of a long time to be away from work, but short enough that people can leave those areas of their employment and give it all they've got, and we pass bills, approve a budget, and then we get back to the real world and live with those laws that we pass and those budgets that we approve. And I think that perspective has helped the state of Utah a whole bunch.
Well, that seems like the pay is not huge, right? It's 20-something thousand a year, it seems like.
Yeah, it's even less than that. It's we get paid by the day for the time that you're there, but it's less than that. And it isn't something that you could do serving in our state legislature as your full-time job.
So then why does somebody choose to do it? I mean, when you work with all these people, it seems like it's huge responsibility.
Well, you know, I had an interest. I found an interest in public policy and in politics right out of high school, volunteered on some campaigns, and loved the policy side of it, loved being involved in issues and causes that were bigger than myself. And as I looked I was a small businessman. I ran, my first election I ran for was 2002, and there was an open legislative seat. I talked to my business partner about the possibility of me serving as an elected official, and got a great business partner. We're around the same age. We started this business from scratch, and he was supportive. The reason you get into this, Tyler, is that you want to make a difference. You have opinions. You float those opinions to a district that you'd like to represent, and you make your case to those that are going to vote. And if they like what you say, and you can keep your promises, you get sent back. And there's something. I'm unfortunately for my business partner, I like the public policy side better than I like my day job, which isn't a good thing, by the way, to like that more than what you do for your living. But it's incredibly fulfilling when you can make a difference, or you feel that you're fighting to make a difference. There's something about that fuels you. And I believe with myself, but all the colleagues I serve with, that is the motivation.
When we look at the state of Utah, and the reason I bring you on specifically, the state of Utah is rushing to top of rankings in all sorts of categories. Lowest income inequality, or I guess most income mobility, best quality of life, comes up very high in best run state every year. What do you attribute that to?
Well, you know, I'm a byproduct of that. Those stats that you just read. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and came to Utah to go to college. And I met my wife. She was from Utah, and that made me a Utahan, which I'm very grateful for. But I came from an area of the country in the United States where the steel industry in Pittsburgh was coming to a halt. The last steel mill closed, I believe, in 1986. I was in high school at the time. And if you think about Pittsburgh, that was its main economic engine for generations. And we saw the population dwindling. The opportunity to go out and make a living and be successful seemed harder and harder. And you come out to a state like Utah and you see the growth and you see the economic opportunities that are here. And I think that just where we don't have those income gaps that you're talking about, it's because we have a very healthy economy where if you want to put in your work and you want to put up your sign in the door and make a go of it, this is a place where you can make it happen. What state government has to do, politicians have to understand, we don't create that economic activity. We don't buy the numbers we put on spreadsheets create the revenue that arrives. What state government has to do is make sure that we don't have a suffocating regulatory climate, that we don't take business and make it so difficult to be successful in our state that they would look for other places to expand or relocate. We want to be that state where businesses come to, and we've seen that. In my district in Draper that I represent, eBay moved their PayPal division that was in California to Utah, and specifically to Draper, bringing 1,200 jobs with them. And we see that all across Adobe as a major campus in Utah County. We're seeing the tech sector grow. And, you know, technology companies, they don't need to be attached to a river or to certain geography. It is all about quality of life for those campuses, those high-tech campuses. And so Utah is becoming a great draw for some of that economic engine, or that we call it the Silicon Slopes. But the way you do it is you try to keep a regulatory climate that is not threatening to business. It's responsible, but it's not one that would slow down economic growth. And our tax burden, we want to make sure that it's not one that, again, would chase away corporate expansion or business expansion or relocation. We want to have a tax burden. We think that the rising tide lifts all ships. If you have more people employed, you have more jobs coming to this state and more people working, that's how, and those people pay their taxes, that's how the revenue arrives in a state government, so that they can pay the bills for public education, our roads, health care, things like that.
Thank you. I'm curious, you know, one of the areas where Utah, I guess 5 years ago, if you'd said to me, Utah will lead the way on an anti-gay discrimination bill, I would have laughed at you. So there's no way that's
possible. I might have laughed a year ago, Tyler. I'm not kidding.
Can you talk about that, though? Because
yeah, I can. Let me say that the LDS Church, obviously the predominant faith in the state of Utah, it's a stakeholder in our community in Utah, came out with a game-changing statement where they came out. It was the second day of our session. I talked about how short our sessions are. On day two of our general session back in January, the LDS Church and its apostles came forward and said, we want to look at an a religious liberty / anti-discrimination legislation that we support that would treat people with respect and dignity and humanely. And whether it's the church that you attend or the faith that you express or the makeup of your household, and that kind of one eye to just how we treat one another really took root. And we saw two bills come through the legislative session that did not narrowly define or protect religious liberties or be anti-discrimination policy, but more broadly addressed all of these situations, or much of it, with a more even hand. And so I honestly thought, and this was not an easy bill to pass, it was one that we were taking on in a short session. There was a lot of people, it's a different concept, but we got through it. And I had thought as we were doing this that we will be successful, it'll be difficult, but we will get there, and then history will one day point to the wisdom of this kind of approach. Well, history turned into maybe a week after our session ended in March, when we saw the state of Indiana go through all the problems they were, where their legislation only addressed the religious liberty side. And for your listeners, I don't know if they noticed, but that state went through terrible protests and businesses threatening to leave the state because they felt that their legislation was too myopic. It was preferential to those with seeking religious liberties, but leaving out those who feel potentially discriminated against because of the makeup of their household or their sexual preference. And it did not go well. And Utah, just within a week of our session ending, by contrast, we had the New York Times, the Washington Post, we had The Economist, had papers of record, journalists from around the world, literally, looking at the model that we came up with in Utah. And so very quickly, the legislation we've passed has been shown to be a game changer in this kind of this area of public policy. And we're proud of it. It's a different brand of conservative, but get the job done, be practical approach that I'm proud that our state is really setting the pace.
Thanks for that. I have one question for you that kind of covers all of this as we wrap up. I'm curious, when I sit down with friends from various backgrounds and I start to explain what we've done here in Utah and how wonderful it is, they always say, oh yeah, well that's not replicable. You're Utah, you're Mormons, whatever. It's do you feel like the model here with the state government and the things that we've done, that can go to other states and be successful?
Listen, Tyler, I don't think it. I know it. I was in Boise this week talking about some landmark legislation that I passed before I was Speaker of the House on quality preschool for at-risk children. We found a way that is a bipartisan solution that conservatives can be proud of, where people come in and invest in programs that help these children. And when they enter our public schools, if they were going to cost the state and our public education system money because of special education needs, when those extra costs are not there and there is a savings, a cost avoidance in the state, we reimburse those that have paid for that preschool. That's not been done before. And we did it here in the state of Utah. And I was in Boise talking to their Chamber of Commerce and their advocates for preschool, talking about this legislation, and they are looking to file those very bills. I was in Seattle this week as well, talking about the Utah model. And we have opinion leaders and we have legislators from around the country that really do seek out best practices. And we're on to something here in the state of Utah. And we have bills that look just like the things that we've run successfully in our state that are in state houses across the country now. And I think that we will, it's not unique to Utah to find these kinds of solutions. Leaders and elected officials can do right by the people they represent and get the job done. We've just had a bad example, in my opinion, out there in the Beltway in Washington, D.C., where gridlock is all you see. But in state, in these laboratories of democracy where you have the state governments looking for solutions and succeeding, states like Utah have a lot to offer and a lot to share.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us.
Tyler, thanks for having me on your program. Happy to participate anytime.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for downloading the podcast. Do you disagree with something I said? You're probably not alone. Shoot me an email at tpage@politepolitics.com, and if you make a good point, I'll read it on the air.